For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium for the best in books and accessible reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, things take a decidedly comic turn. Robin Driscoll tells us how writing his first thriller compares to script writing for Mr. Bean.
It's up to the viewer to fill in the gaps, but with a book, you can be right inside that character's head.
Actor and comedian Helen Lederer reveals some of the fact behind the fiction in her comic novel, Losing It.
There was a madness to it, which I can do. I can go down that mad road.
Stand-up comedian Robin Ince confesses his love of bad books.
Even though it's called bad books, I fought against that because I think they're books that are wonderfully different.
And there's another chance to hear a comic short story that was a runner-up in last year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Robin Driscoll is best known for his work as a TV script writer. After cutting his teeth on Alas, Smith & Jones, he became the main writer for Mr. Bean. Now he's turned his hand to thrillers. His debut novel, Rough Music, has been described by Richard Curtis, the creator of Four Weddings and a Funeral and Blackadder, as a cracking, breathless plot, with every sentence stiletto heel sharp and witty. It's out now, and Robin Driscoll joined me down the line from his home in Sussex. Robin Driscoll, welcome to Read On.
Hiya.
Could you tell us a little bit more about Rough Music?
Well, it's set in Manhattan, and a corporate lawyer, Rag McBain, he moved to the States when he was 10, taken there by his parents. He's a corporate lawyer, and for various reasons, he embezzles and does a runner with $25 million belonging to the Russian mafia. And he goes and hides away on the Scottish Isle of his birth. And the person given the job of tracking him down and getting the money back is his ex-girlfriend, who thinks that she's been dumped for the money. So it's a mystery thriller, and there are sort of two mysteries intertwined.
And it's also very, very funny. I mean, there are some razor-sharp lines in there which definitely betray your past as a comic writer for Alas, Smith & Jones.
Well, how nice of you. Well, when I decided to actually write a book, people expected me to write a comedy, obviously. But I fancied writing what I like to read, and that is espionage, thrillers, crime, that kind of thing. So I started, but I just couldn't help not put in the funny stuff. It's in my DNA, you know. Got to have a giggle. So it was a fine balance, really, of you know, all the elements of a mystery thriller with comedy thrown in. But I think I managed it.
I think very successfully. It had me laughing throughout and turning the pages. What are the main differences in script writing for one-hour TV comedy shows and plotting an entire novel?
Well, it's strange to say that. I started on this book, in my first book, about 4 years ago. And I sent the first seven chapters to a friend of mine, a writer, and he emailed me back and he said, we must meet. You can't write. And so, you know, I was a bit up in arms. I said, you know, what do you mean I can't write? You know, I understand story structure. I understand character curves, character development. What are you talking about? And in 10 minutes, he showed me that I had absolutely no idea to write a book, that it was a totally different craft. And so I spent a year learning how to do it. And, you know, got into it, and Rough Music is the result.
Did you go on a creative writing course, or did you just do lots and lots of research?
There's a lot online. You know, if you're thinking of writing a book, go to any big bookstore, Waterstones, there'll be a section on writing. The expression, there's a book in everyone. Well, I'm sure there is, but you've got to take the time to learn how to do it. The way my friend put it, he said, well, look, come on, he said, even if you were a plumber, you wouldn't install central heating in your own house without learning how to do it first. And that's a very good point, I think.
As a blind person, I have always found Mr. Bean a little bit impenetrable because so much of it is observational humour. And so I must say, I came to this book thinking, you know, how is a man who writes this great observational humour actually going to translate that into scene setting for a book that actually roams quite a lot over the globe? And yet you clearly are able to translate what you see into words very effectively.
Well, I think, you know, writing Mr. Bean, writing comedy without dialogue for so many years, you really get to grips with what, you know, how film writers work, that basically the poetry is in the pictures. You don't understand a character because you can't get inside their heads. You can only judge them by the decisions they make and the actions that they perform. And it's up to the viewer to fill in the gaps. But with a book, you can be right inside that character's head. And so the audience has got a lot more information. I must say that my book is very filmic in the sense that it is very picture orientated, and I tend to call them scenes, you know, rather than sections or excerpts or chapters. And I treat them in exactly the same way as I would a script, even the structure. You know, everything is a three-act play. A good joke is in three acts, a good book, a good film, a television episode. And they're very basic, classic storytelling rules that can be bent, you know, and played around with. But working on Mr. Bean really did sort of hone my skills for actually creating pictures. I mean, if you were to read a Mr. Bean script, it would be very, very, very boring and not a joke on the page, because it's a manual, because there's no clue, that the humour isn't, there's no dialogue. There's no comedy when there's no dialogue. But of course, you know, in the hands of the masterly Rowan Atkinson, that manual is translated into stuff that makes us laugh. So don't ever bother trying to read a Mr. Bean script.
Did you work very closely with Rowan Atkinson? Were you in the same room?
Yes, all the time. Yes, Rowan Atkinson and Richard Curtis asked me to join them in writing Mr. Bean after the pilot was successful. And we started off, they worked very much in the same way that I did in my early days when I had a theatre company and a comedy theatre company. And most of our work started with improvisation. So you give yourself a situation and write, what can we do in this situation that is funny? And that's how Richard and Rowan have always worked. But then I certainly started to write a lot more down, because that was what I was used to. And Richard became more and more taken up with Comic Relief, his charity. So in the end, it was left to me to do most of the writing. And so in the end, it all ended up on a page, except for when Rowan put himself in the geography, and there are various props in the room, and so of course he wouldn't hesitate but to think up a joke on the spot and do something physical. It was a joy to work on that show.
Going back to London 2012 Olympics, to have Mr. Bean representing Great Britain in front of a TV audience of hundreds of millions. Mr. Bean is part of the British DNA now, isn't he?
It looks like it. I mean, the wonderful thing about Mr. Bean is that there's always an audience, because, you know, new generations have been born. And so it can be taken out and dusted down and shown to them from as young as 5 years old to 80. And it sells around the world very well. It sells to over 250 countries. So there's a great demand for it. Oh, and also the animations as well, the animated Mr. Bean, the cartoons, which is about to start writing the third series of 52 brand new ones, which hopefully will be out in about 18 months, because the demand is there around the world just to create more and more Bean. The comedy isn't bound by dialogue. So any country in the world will recognise the character. And it's clean, you know, there's nothing smutty. So Middle Eastern countries, for instance, lap it up. I've got some Bangladeshi friends who apparently watch Mr. Bean reruns in Bangladesh at midnight, sat around a lake with a large screen in the middle of an island. And it's a treat. Practically every night they'll show a Mr. Bean episode. I've been in Cyprus and seen a Mr. Bean episode projected on the wall of the restaurant. Because you don't even need sound. I don't know if you've ever seen an aeroplane and there's a Mr. Bean film on and everyone's got their earphones on. And it doesn't matter what country people come from. You just hear people laugh. But you can't hear what they're laughing at. And the reason why we haven't got Mr. Bean in front of a camera is because Rowan feels that his hair is getting a wee bit grey to play the character.
Robin Driscoll, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Rough Music is available commercially in paperback and as an ebook, and Robin will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support, so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
I think the whole talking book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
Joanna Trollope on the RNIB Talking Book Service.
I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the talking books do, and what the RNIB, I think, does in general, is save sanities before you know you get to the end of your life. I mean, the number of people whose lives have been transformed by talking books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that, you know, their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasise how important that is. It is, it's partly story and reading and accessibility to books and the access to the possibilities of one's imagination and one's mind. It's because we've all got to live with the insides of our own heads, and if you are driven back without any outside stimulus, you've just got your own powers, it's, you can go a bit crackers. You know, this expands your imaginative world in an extraordinary way. I can identify very intensely with how it feels to need the stimulus of reading and not be able to access it.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's show for those passionate about books and reading. Still to come on this week's show, Robert Kirkwood discovers what Robin Ince does outside the infinite monkey cage, and we'll be serving up a decidedly fishy short story. But first, someone else who's made the transition from TV comedy to writing for the page is comedian Helen Lederer. She first emerged as part of the alternative comedy boom at the beginning of the 1980s and has remained a regular on television screens ever since. Her first novel, Losing It, is out now in print and audio. And, as she told Robert Kirkwood, she's keen to write more. Here's a clip.
"Is that it, then?" Millie inquired, looking at the only drink placed on the shiny counter. It was not the one she wanted. The girl looked confused. Yeah? Oh, do you want a straw with that? She asked. Will that take long, do you think? Asked Millie. No, don't think so. They're just here. The girl pointed at a straw holder next to Millie's glass. She didn't seem overly concerned, but then she was probably too young and thin to be able to relate to Millie's trauma at seeing her reflection. I can bring it over to you if you'd like. The girl planted a straw in the glass and looked pleased. I'll take it with me, thanks, Millie said firmly. She'd finally received an alcoholic drink, with a straw. She just had to make the best of it.
I spoke to Helen at the I Write Book Festival in Glasgow.
I'm Helen Lederer, and I've just written Losing It, a comedy novel published by Pan Macmillan. It's my third attempt at a novel. I abandoned the other two. This one is about Millie, i.e. me, a woman, mid-lit, I've called it as a genre, a woman of 50-plus, who's in debt, divorced and desperate, and suddenly she gets the chance to earn 20 grand if she can lose 3 stone in 3 months to stop the bailiffs coming to take her house away. So it's will she, won't she, but actually it's more about her dysfunctioning brain, which is more like mine, and her relationship with her daughter, and it's just basically a comedy novel, but with that is the spine of the story.
You've alluded to it a couple of times in that one answer, but how autobiographical is it?
Well, I did actually get offered money to do a herbal diet pill, which I took, but I didn't actually lose the weight. I went frantic. So I know about the pressure. So that did happen. It was really funny. And in my life, I've done absolutely everything to try and lose weight. So that's real as well. I think I've done everything that's in the book. But storytelling in a novel form, that's new. And it's not an autobiography at all. It's a story. It's a novel. But I think like the character, or get inside the head of the other characters. So it's a joy. It's been a joy to do, I tell you, lovely.
If you yourself have had weight issues in the past, how brave was it for you to do the show called Splash?
Well, what I did is I went into denial to do the show called Splash. I hadn't done a sort of reality. I'd done Come Dine With Me years before. I hadn't done a reality, and I needed the money, I decided, and it wasn't that much either. I think it was graded. I didn't get the most. I was in the middle. That's typical of me. I just thought, I don't know, there was a madness to it, which I can do. I can go down that mad road. Went into denial, did it, tried not to think about it, and then actually, then it's over. And I did dive, and I did learn how to dive.
Millie drank as she walked. Half the contents disappeared in 2 sucks. Why had she left her readers in the car? And why was Florence wearing pop socks? This was new. Where were the usual denim leggings, which Florence always called jeans? Florence had clearly not made her usual frothy, look at me, I'm not really 60 effort, which was the opposite of Millie's trick the eye downwards method. She was sipping peaceably enough from a tumbler of Bailey's, but the beige pop socks made her legs look as if they'd been in an accident and fought with the allure of the lace and floral tiered skirt.
Now, how are you finding the book selling process with tours and festivals like this?
Selling the book is very stressful for me. I want to go back to that time when I'm writing in my pyjamas with nobody being horrible to me, or thinking when I open a newspaper, oh, I should be in it, or walking past a bookshop going, is my book in there? You know, it's such a new world of, and no wonder writers are anxious, because it isn't just about writing it. And then other normal people are on to their next book immediately. Whereas I've kind of made an appointment, I start the next book in a 3 weeks' time when I've sorted all this out, I hope. But this, you know, how long is a piece of string? You can just go on and on thinking you've got to sell it. If it was in hardback, I've sold enough to make it into a bestseller, I've been told, but it wasn't in hardback. So there are all these new rules, and you go, why wasn't it in hardback? I think I'm selling them regularly, but, it's a new genre, female comedy fiction, and I feel I need to bang a drum a bit about the kind of, it's not so much about romance, it's about comedy, although there is romance in it.
So much so you've established an award.
Well, I've set up Comedy Women in Print because this all came to me at the same time, thinking there is no celebration of wit from women. Now, it's not a sort of separatist in a bad way, I don't feel. There's the Bayliss Prize I've been a judge on that is for comedy female fiction, because it's felt there's a need for that in the canvas of literary prizes. So I'm moving that forward as soon as I can. We were hoping to start in autumn. We think we've got a sponsor. So this is a whole new world. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, and all I want to do is write a book.
Are you comfortable at events like this with your stand-up background?
Well, I can do it. I get very nervous. I always have very anxious before I go on stage, and that's just how I'm made. Doesn't really get any easier, but I think I just accepted that I have to go into that place. So I'm not great to talk to, as I am with you, Robert, right now, because I'm thinking about the adrenaline rush. Also, I'm going to be talking to someone who's very intelligent and accomplished and a member, a pillar of the Scottish society. So I'd love to meet her socially. She intrigues me. But on stage, asking questions, oh, my goodness.
Now, you narrated the audiobook yourself. How was that?
Well, that was lovely. Lovely to be able to get the chance to do it. I noticed quite a few mistakes and made notes, errors. But just should the publishers want to publish some more, because I'd learned again there will always be errors in every book, even though you know you have these very sort of anal people going through it with a magnifying glass. But I love doing it. I found it. I'm very quick when I read books. I'm narrating a television documentary at the moment, and they can't believe there's something about my brain. I just do it very fast, I think.
So you are quite good at the narration then, yeah?
I love narrating. I love radio. I've done quite a lot of children's narration in the days when, of course, there were more children's DVDs. You know, the world's changed, so there's a different demand for that. But I know that I just love making a list of all the characters and remembering who I'm supposed to be in a little dark room, and I just really get off on it. I love it.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I think there's something really nice about listening to an audiobook on the long journey, and I've got picked some up from Oxfam for those. I think we did have a thriller, Dalgleish thriller. That's quite fun. That makes the motorway pass quicker, but not hugely. Again, it's you know, the world moves so fast, and it's not as it used to be. It's not as normal as it used to be. There used to be a wonderful audio place in Bath with all the photographs, all the people reading it. It was a real, you'd see your mates doing it. Well, that's closed down now, so it's a different world, really.
How important is it that your work and all books are available to everyone, regardless of their site?
It's really important, especially in a climate where the convention has changed and social media is so fast and people are changing how they communicate anyway. The fact that you have got this resource of authors or actors reading good content is crucial, and I'm really proud to even be talking to you about it. It's something I really feel strongly about it. I really, really do.
Florence was different from Millie. She had an inoffensive figure. Bosomy, short, but three classes a week of bums, tums and abs had kept her body in the normal range for an older person. She also did early morning yoga, which Millie found excessive. Well, it's hard, isn't it, to keep it up, what with everything?
Thanks to Helen Lederer and Robert Kirkwood. Is there a book in the library that lifts your mood or gives you a fit of the giggles? Why not share it with us by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk? We'd love to hear from you.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books, although I don't like to remind myself, for about 20 years. I think my first book was Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. And I remember that was a bit of a lesson for me, as I had to learn to sit still and be very careful about my enunciation. One of my favorite books over all those years, because we laugh so much, was Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor. It reminded me of my old radio days, although maybe they weren't as funny as Garrison Keillor's radio days. Back in Toronto, when I was a child, I had a program, and it was on Saturday mornings, but also then I did drama with young children on Saturday mornings with fairy stories. It was called Doorway to Fairyland. So it reminded me of all that, the good old times in CBC Radio in Toronto, but also because Garrison Keillor is very funny, it was a joy to read.
Studio B was the Snakebite studio at WLT, the tomb of the radio mummy, and bad things happened to people who went in there. It was a big triangular room on the second floor of the Hotel Ogden, where WLT was located, at 12th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis. Dad Benson said it felt like a vacuum chamber. Once, he gasped for breath during Friendly Neighbor, and two huge flies dove into his throat and almost choked him. The Reverend Irving James Knox claimed he couldn't hear himself talk in there when he did Hope for Tomorrow. He was used to sanctuaries where his words rolled off the walls like ocean surf. In Studio B, the waves hit a big sponge. Reed Seymour once got the hiccups so bad in there his partial plate came off and he had to gum the news. And a week later, three of the Shepherd Boys, a gospel quartet, slipped in and quietly de-pantsed him during a long account of a tragic house fire, leaving six persons dead in St. Paul. He kept reading, but he yipped twice when they pulled off his shorts. Every other day or so, the shepherds snuck in during the noontime news to play their little tricks. They put spit in his water glass and pelted him with food and poured mucilage in his shoes, and one day they lit the script on fire and he had to read very fast. It was an obituary, and he never got to the survived by part. So the next day, Reed locked the studio door. Then, after the newscast was safely delivered, the door wouldn't unlock. That was the sort of thing that happened in Studio B.
I love reading here because, first of all, it's a very friendly atmosphere, and the studios are good, and the books are generally worthy. Now I hope to continue reading for another 20 years. I hope you, as well as I, enjoy the talking books that are done here at the RNIB, and thanks for listening to them.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, an encounter with the hairy wet fish from last year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. But before that, a recent addition to the RNIB Talking Books Library is The Infinite Monkey Cage, How to Build a Universe. Here's a clip.
The Infinite Monkey Cage presents How to Build a Universe, Part 1, by Professor Brian Cox, Robin Ince, and Alexandra Feacham.
I'm not sure about the title, actually.
No, I'm not sure about it either. We had a lot of debates about this, didn't we? Because I'm not entirely sure that, after reading this, you will be able to build a universe, because what I've got in my back garden is a right old mess.
I suppose that's why it's Part 1. It's kind of an introduction to building a universe, although there's very little, I agree, about building a universe in it.
It's got some practical hints, but I don't believe you'll be able to get a full universe, but you should be able to get, I hope, your own singular cellular life form by the end of it.
You think?
Anyway, so we'll start the Monkey Cage book with a beginning, and we have a very special forward, and you got Eric Idle to write this, didn't you?
Yeah, we're a very good friend. I think, actually, if I ring him up, I think he'll do it. Well, he will do it. He'll do it for me.
Okay, great to have Eric Idle at the beginning of the book. Yeah.
Right. I'll turn it off touch tone so that people can't work out his number.
Yeah.
Hello? Hello, Eric?
Hello?
Is that Eric?
Who's this?
It's Brian.
Brian who?
Brian Cox.
You're the actor?
Oh, no, I'm the other one.
Oh, the other one. How's that going?
It's going very well indeed. It's going. finding out new secrets of the universe as we speak. But
And you can never keep them. That's the thing about you, isn't it?
Yeah. Listen, Eric, we're recording the audiobook for The Infinite Monkey Cage, How to Build a Universe, and you were kind enough to write an introduction. Would it be possible for you to read your introduction for the audiobook?
That's not an introduction, that's a warning. I don't want people being seduced into buying this book just because they have my dulcet tones on the recording.
Oh, right. Well, so the answer's a no, then.
Well, anyway, good luck with the whole book enterprise thing, you know. We started that Christmas book, I did, actually, in about 1969 or 70, with Monty Python's Big Red Book, and a jolly good thing it was, too, because we sold thousands of copies to the unsuspecting British public.
Is it still available?
No.
Well, thank you very much, Eric Idle.
Well, you're very welcome, Brian Cox.
All right, then, well, we'll have to do the forward then.
That didn't sound very nice.
You said you're friends with him.
Co-hosts Robin Ince and Brian Cox are well known for their antics on Radio 4's show about science and space, but Robin Ince also has a passion for bad books, as he told Robert Kirkwood at iWrite a couple of years back.
Comedian, writer, broadcaster and now defender of libraries invites you to join his Bad Book Club. And he joins me now. Robin Ince, thank you for joining me.
Very happy to join you. I should say, even though it's called Bad Books, I fought against that because I think they're books that are wonderfully different. And some of them are bad as well, but some of them are just... They are in the arena of the peculiar, I suppose.
Now, we're talking about the book, but am I correct in thinking that it actually started out as a live show?
Yes, it was years ago. I was doing a show, and in that show I read a little bit from Sid Little's autobiography, Little Goes a Long Way. And then I got bored when I was... It was during the Edinburgh Festival, and I thought, oh, I want to do some other things as well. So I would go to late-night shows with books I'd found in charity shops that day. So they would be Strange Meals and Boom books, weird horror books, self-help books. And each night I would read from one of these books with kind of Elgar in the background or Philip Glass or something like that to add to kind of pomposity.
Are you ever embarrassed buying them?
There is a... I have to admit that men's... There's one about men's secret fantasies, which is just big pictures of men fishing with very little on. And also the Yoga for Men book, which even though it's Yoga for Men, only has pictures of topless women doing their exercises. And I always feel that I have to say, I'm a big fan of the bad book. And this is... What I do is I'll have to buy a book by Emil Zola or something like that if I'm buying that as well. So at least they may well think that I'm an intellectual and classy pervert. I would say the greater embarrassment is when I buy political books by columnists that are totally against what I believe in. So they will be, you know, when I buy a Richard Littlejohn book, it's a little bit like sometimes you're caught reading a bad right-wing tabloid on some form of public transport, and you have to go, I just picked up, it was on the seat next to me, I certainly haven't paid 60 pence for this.
So can you tell us how to pick up sexy girls?
Well, The Secret of Picking Up Sexy Girls was a book that I found in Scotland, in fact. I found it in Aberdeen, as far as I remember. And it's just this incredible book written in 1975, which tells you, first of all, where to meet sexy girls, which can be anywhere from a discotheque to perhaps a conservatory or municipal garden. Then it shows how to impress them by perhaps knowing the Latin name of a flower. And then it tells you how to take their clothes off. And it covers everything from hat to tights. So each one has its own paragraph, and it's a very strange book. It tells you what sexy girls are as well, in case you haven't actually been able to work out using your own senses what you would find sexually alluring. It tells you, well, for instance, people over 60, it says, are not that they have this horrible line where it just goes, over 60, we are not at all attracted to these people. So that's just the blanket ban,
or possibly a concert hippie.
There's hippies in it. There's lots about kind of hygiene and who you can't never trust a woman with a wig. If you see a woman with a bow in her hair, that's right. That means it must be real hair, for a wig never has a bow in it. And the author also is very anti the bra as well. He feels that the bra can only lead to a deceitful woman.
And it goes the other way, because there's information on women how to pick up men at boat and boat building areas.
That's one of my favourites, is that there are... That's actually from... what's that called? I should know. It's been such... How to Marry the Man of Your Choice. And How to Marry the Man of Your Choice was written in the 80s. It's about a decade after The Secret of Picking Up Sexy Girls. Now the women are finding the men of their choice. They're allowed to choose their own man now because it's the 80s. And that's packed with don't have long fingernails. Long fingernails may suggest that you are unwilling to do household tasks and unavailable for recreational activities. And then there's things, again, it gives you a guide on hats and tights and skirt lengths should be short but within the normal range for where you live. This is the advice. And yes, boat building, as you mentioned, that is a very good job. If you're in boat repair, sales and service, you will possibly meet the man of your choice.
Now, while we're here, we should talk about the Infinite Monkey Cage and the tour Uncaged Monkeys with Brian Cox and other famous science names.
Well, the idea was, I love science. The other side, when I'm not buying Mills and Boone and strange books about picking up men of your choice, I love reading about Charles Darwin, Thomas Huxley, books by Carl Sagan. I love astronomy, cosmology, the whole thing. And I started to do shows. I wanted to do passionate shows. Much as the book club may well have its tongue in its cheek and be perhaps a little bit sarcastic, I wanted to do a show that was just passion and excitement about the universe and what lies within it and the mysteries of it. And it started in just small subterranean clubs, and now we're actually doing a big tour with Brian Cox, who does Wonders of the Universe at the moment, Wonders of the Solar System, Simon Singh, Ben Goldacre, and Alan Moore, the comic book writer who wrote V for Vendetta and Watchmen. He will be joining us for some. He, the last time I worked with him, did a wonderful thing where he proved that it was as logical to worship a sock puppet as it was to understand some of modern physics.
And finally, you're quite a prolific tweeter on Twitter, and a lot of those have been retweets about saving libraries, including the RNIB Talking Books Library. Why do you think libraries are so important?
Everyone should have access to not just information, but the joy of reading, of understanding. I mean, I think with things like talking books, to have the access, and you can't, you know, it's very difficult to get hold of these when you go to a bookshop. Bookshops have very limited. It's a library's duty, and it's our duty to live in a civilized society where everyone has the right to be entertained by books, to learn from books. Some of the greatest writers, some of the greatest entertainers, some of the most passionate scientists, they started their real existence, their modern existence, by going to the library. And it doesn't matter how much you earn, everyone can go to the library. Now, yeah, it is something that I, as an 8-year-old, I remember my first trip to the library. Before then, I went to the mobile library. When I take my 3-year-old to the library and I see the excitement, and it takes 2 hours to choose his books, yeah, this is something that should be available to everyone.
Robin Ince, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
As Kate Bellingham told us in 1994, imagine a world where every word ever written, every picture ever painted, every film ever shot could be viewed instantly in your home via an information superhighway, a high-capacity digital communication network. It sounds pretty grand, but in fact, this is already happening on something called the Internet. That's right, something called the Internet. 1994, that's how exotic and bizarre the Internet was. Imagine a world without something called the Internet. Imagine how hard it would be to shop, watch, or destabilise democracy and seed disinformation.
As children, the divide between science, pseudoscience, and plain nonsense was not as marked in our minds as it is now. But perhaps paradoxically, the lines were more clearly drawn in public discourse. In his book The Demon-Haunted World, published in 1995, Carl Sagan wrote, "I have a foreboding of an America in my children or grandchildren's time when the United States is a service and information economy, when nearly all the key manufacturing industries have slipped away to other countries, when awesome technological powers are in the hands of a very few, and no one representing the public interest can even grasp the issues. When the people have lost the ability to set their own agendas or knowledgeably question those in authority. When, clutching our crystals and nervously consulting our horoscopes, our critical faculties in decline, unable to distinguish between what feels good and what is true, we slide, almost without noticing, back into superstition and darkness." Sagan would have been horrified if his editor had said, "Carl, perhaps remove the grandchildren line."
Robin Ince and Professor Brian Cox narrating The Infinite Monkey Cage, How to Build a Universe, which is TB702311.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
They've found her, my lord! Ned rose quickly. Her men or Lannisters? It was Jory. Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendor in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The north went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone, but a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking book number 19231.
Tell Jory to bring her here at once. I am sorry, my lord, Poole told him. The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the Queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the King.
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Before we return to Robin Driscoll for the books of his life, here's another chance to listen to a runner-up from the prose category of last year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. The theme was anniversaries, and Russell Richards gave it a comic twist with his story, The Hairy Wet Fish.
The Hairy Wet Fish. Last summer marked the 11th anniversary of the disappearance of my sight. Or as good as. Last November marked the 2nd anniversary of the arrival of my guide dog, and last summer, the arrival of the hairy wet fish. We waited, poised, the bumps of the sensory paving beneath our feet, listening for the sound of the car engines to subside, listening for the gap of noise that would be our chance to cross. Before the hole in the sound, a voice piped up, loud, enthusiastic, and with authority. "It's clear, mate," said the voice. "I stopped the traffic, you can cross," said the voice. I heard the car door open and bang shut. I heard the idling engines. I heard the first impatient horns. I heard my would-be saviour's repeated instructions to cross, his slightly more flighty voice much closer now. More engines, more horns, some shouts. Then a hand gripped my free wrist and with considerable assertion, half led, half pulled me across the road. Fluster, embarrassment, annoyance, and the need to get the situation out of the way made me thank the self-appointed saviour, and I breathed relief as the engine sparked back to accelerating life and moved on. People are strange. The thing brushed the top of my head as both dog and me moved smartly along the path. My head dipped instinctively, as it had dozens of times before. A quick reflex arc and we continued on our way. My first encounter with the fish. People are strange. A woman's voice.
"What's he for? What's he do? Some of them can tell you when the phone rings, you know,"
the voice said. I had stopped. I smiled, aware of her ruffling my dog, aware of the Celtic tinge, but not yet the stereotype bias I was about to jump to.
"Can he see the little people?" she went on. "Does he know what they do?" she said.
I thought leprechauns. I thought elves and fairies. And I'm ashamed to say, I thought loony. She chatted on, and then the all-too-slow incoming penny dropped. The little people were matchstick figures. The thick white matchstick figures painted onto the pavement. The figures next to the representations of bicycles used to separate the pedestrian from the cyclist. We parted. People are strange. It was roughly 76 paces to the fish. I brushed it against it with my head enough times now, and it was growing in size. It was some sort of conifer branch. Sometimes we hit it, sometimes we didn't. A man's voice.
"You should have a f***ing muzzle on that thing, mate,"
followed by a threat to come over and smack me one. I wouldn't, and he didn't. People are strange. Almost 76 paces, and I hit the fish. But this time it was different. This was when I first began to refer to it as the fish. It had rained all night, and what hit me in the face was a hairy, wet fish. Not a tip of fern on the bonce, but a fat, wet, hairy, ocean-going cod right in the mush. The woman's voice was loud, constant and insistent, and it had arrived from nowhere. Up she piped. "He's checking the traffic now," she continued. "He's waiting for the right time. He'll take you across soon. My friend's had a guide dog for years. Your dog will know when it's clear. They train them to stop if it's busy. My friend's dog takes her everywhere." The woman continues to fill me in on the do's and don'ts of the guide dog world. Then as suddenly as she arrived, she disappears. People are strange. I hit the hairy wet fish for the umpteenth time. It's growing larger by the day. Something must be done to stop my regular slap in the face, not to mention the drenching that now sometimes comes with it. It's the hairy wet fish or me. Ting-ling! Ting-ling! No other noise, no voice, no words, no sound at all, except the ting-ling of a stationary bicycle bell at my side. I wait. They wait. Not a word. Not a sound except another ting-a-ling. I wait. They wait. Not a word. I wait. They leave. The sound of an exiting bicycle. Spooky. People are strange. I hear the vehicle stop. I hear the engine not stop. I hear the footsteps. I'm regaled with enthusiasm as a complete stranger proceeds to give me some uninvited instructions concerning the operation of the Pelican Crossing. I'm introduced to the wait button. Warned about the impending bleeps and the distance to a similar box and button conveniently placed on the other side of the road, I'm about to speak, but then pause, think better of it, nod approvingly, express my thanks, and take myself across with a backward wave of thanks. People are strange, but I like to think we both felt better about ourselves for the encounter. Ring the council about the overhanging fish. No, type a neat little note with the words, "Please cut me. Thank you." Put it in a clear plastic bag and tie it to the offending fish. No, enough's enough. I'm ready and willing and I have a plan, and what's more, I'm tooled up. Armed with my new macho vernacular, we meticulously count out the paces to the hairy wet fish. The hairy wet fish smacks me in the face. With practiced deftness, out come my garden shears. With determined gusto, I part cut, part saw, and part tear the branch holding the fish, all the while waiting for a shout of, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" The shout doesn't come. I drag what feels like a small tree back to the green garden waste bin and stuff it in. I feel great. People are strange.
The Hairy Wet Fish, written by Russell Richards. The deadline for entries to this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition is now past, and we'll bring you the results as soon as the judges have completed their deliberations. Have you found a hidden gem of comic genius in the RNIB library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital book. Borkintuk?
Borkintuk, yeah. It's a new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake. And if...
Damn.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Robin Driscoll for the books of his life. Robin, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Absolutely. At the time when every young man and young ladies reach 15, 16, that's the time to read Tolkien, Lord of the Rings. Well, I didn't do that. In those days, you either read Tolkien or you read an author called Mervyn Peake, and Gormenghast, or the Gormenghast trilogy, was a fantasy series, and it was very, very, very dark and very cinematic. So that was the first one that made a great impression on me.
Titus is seven. His confines, Gormenghast. Suckled on shadows, weaned, as it were, on webs of ritual. For his ears, echoes. For his eyes, a labyrinth of stone. And yet, within his body, something other than this umbrageous legacy. For first and ever foremost, he is child. A ritual more compelling than ever man devised is fighting anchored darkness. A ritual of the blood, of the jumping blood. These quicks of sentience owe nothing to his forebears, but to those feckless hosts a trillion deep of the globe's childhood. The gift of the bright blood, of blood that laughs when the tenets mutter weep, of blood that mourns when the seer laws croak rejoice. O little revolution in great shade. Titus the 77th, heir to a crumbling summit, to a sea of nettles, to an empire of red rust, to ritual's footprints ankle-deep in stone. Gormenghast. Withdrawn and ruinous, it broods in umbra, the immemorial masonry, the towers, the tracts. Is all corroding? No. Through an avenue of spires, a zephyr floats. A bird whistles. A freshet bears away from a choked river. Deep in a fist of stone, a doll's hand wriggles, warm, rebellious on the frozen palm. A shadow shifts its length. A spider stirs. And darkness winds between the characters.
Malcolm Rithen narrating Gormenghast by Mervyn Peake, which is TB5596. All three books in the trilogy are available from the RNIB Library in Braille and as talking books. And is there a book that on a rainy day with nothing else to do you'd like to curl up with on the sofa and read as comfort food?
I love John le Carré, and especially his latest book, A Legacy of Spies. Fantastic story, because poor old Smiley is getting on, and there comes a point in the book where you still haven't met Smiley and you wonder if you ever will, because it's set in the present day with his assistant, Smiley now being retired, and the past comes back to haunt them both, and you meet Smiley eventually, and it's like greeting an old friend. Very, very comforting.
John le Carré's A Legacy of Spies is available commercially in print, audio and ebook formats.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the audience?
Drunk Music by Michael Connelly. Michael Connelly is an American crime writer, and I've read many of his books. Drunk Music is one of the early ones. And they're all set in Los Angeles, and they're very, very dark. Main character is Harry Bosch, Los Angeles police detective. So that's a good tip.
As he drove along Mulholland Drive toward the Cahuenga Pass, Bosch began to hear the music. It came to him in fragments of strings and errant horn sequences, echoing off the brown summer-dried hills and blurred by the white noise of traffic carrying up from the Hollywood freeway. Nothing he could identify. All he knew was that he was heading toward its source. He slowed when he saw the cars parked off to the side of a gravel turnoff road, two detective sedans and a patrol car. Bosch pulled his Caprice in behind them and got out. A single officer in uniform leaned against the fender of the patrol car. Yellow plastic crime scene tape, the stuff used by the Miles in Los Angeles, was strung from the patrol car's side-view mirror across the gravel road to the sign posted on the other side. The sign said, in black on white letters that were almost indistinguishable behind the graffiti that covered the sign, LAFD Fire Control, Mountain Fire District Road. No public admittance, no smoking. The patrol cop, a large man with sun-reddened skin and blonde, bristly hair, straightened up as Bosch approached. The first thing Bosch noted about him, other than his size, was the baton. It was holstered in a ring on his belt, and the business end of the club was marred, the black acrylic paint scratched away to reveal the aluminum beneath. Street fighters wore their battle-scarred sticks proudly as a sign, a not-so-subtle warning. This cop was a headbanger, no doubt about it.
Dick Hill, narrating Trunk Music by Michael Connelly, which is TB14313.
Robin Driscoll, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and sharing your obvious love of reading.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Robin Driscoll. Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.